is the Angry GM, and it's time for another proofread aloud. It is the last day of the month, nearly close of business. I am desperately behind. I am joined by my squeaky chair. The landscaper has just shown up, and my life is in shambles. So this is gonna be a good one. For reasons just stated, there is absolutely no way this will be followed by a supplemental Q&A just to increase the disappointment. But nonetheless, let's enjoy a reading of an article that I have decided to call Ask Angry May 2023 Mailbag. It's time for another Ask Angry Mailbag. That's where I answer a bunch of reader-submitted questions. Are you a reader who wants to submit a question for Answery? Send it to ask.angry@angry.games. Just remember to get to the point, to leave out the extraneous crap, and to tell me explicitly what to call you. Lord Basement Lord asks, a lot of people start Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition player characters at 3rd level rather than 1st level. For a table of people well-versed in the system they're playing, is there any benefit to starting at 1st level? Thanks for your question, Lord Basement Lord, and I mean that sincerely. You gave me clear permission to use the name you supplied, asked a question in 2 concise sentences, and didn't tack any paragraphs of extraneous bullshit context on the end. Nice work! On the end. I gotta correct that. Boo! Okay, that's corrected. Yes, Lordy B. Lord, there are benefits to starting play at 1st level, even if you have expert players. And I'm gonna tell you what they are, and explain why I start pretty much every campaign I run at 1st level in just a moment. But I need you, and everyone reading, to understand that all I'm doing is listing the benefits. I ain't making a case here trying to persuade anyone. So, hopefully, no one will feel like they have to explain why I'm wrong in the comments. As I said, redundant basement lord, I start all my games at 1st level. I do so pretty much regardless of the system I'm running. And the reason I've given in the past is that modern role-playing game characters are such a complicated fucking mess of traits, talents, special abilities, skills, conditional rules, and modifiers that most people can't keep track of all that shit for even a modestly leveled character. Thus, starting at 1st level limits the crap people have to keep track of. By the time they add new things to the sheet, they've had time to get down a lot of stuff that's already there. It's a cognitive load thing, and people just don't recognize how big an issue cognitive load is. While I forgive delusional gamers who always think they're galaxy brain geniuses unfettered by the limitations that every other human brain on the planet struggles with, I can't forgive the game designers for not taking this shit seriously. In theory, a player should know their character well enough that there should be a near zero delay between what does your character do now and I do this thing. Players who complain that combat keeps changing so it's impossible to plan ahead are wrong. You shouldn't have to plan ahead. You should be able to decide almost immediately what to do. And they can't because they're struggling to keep straight the number of options in their head. And it ain't just about optimizing the next action. It's also about keeping conditional modifiers, when you roll a 1 on this kind of roll, you can do this, and reactions, when you see this thing happen in game, you can do that, and so on. Not to mention temporary effects and conditions that arise in play. If you have to reference your character sheet at all, that means there's too much to keep in your human working memory. And if you insist your working memory can handle it, I'll get my stopwatch so you can prove it. If it sounds like I'm dubious of sufficiently experienced as a qualifier for playing a higher level character, that's because I am. If you can't tell me every ability, spell, and modifier on your 3rd level character sheet without looking and summarize how each thing works, conceptually at least, you ain't sufficiently experienced to play it. Sorry. I just need to correct a punctuation issue, so just bear with me a moment. Okay. That said, I don't think there's really any point in worrying about this. See, the 5e designers were hoping people would see the first two levels as optional, but they fucked up the execution by making their whole game at every level put too much cognitive load on players. And that ain't unique to 5e either. It's been that way since 3rd edition, aka the best edition, decided it was best to differentiate characters by the stuff on the sheet rather than through play. And spellcasters have always been stuck with cognitive overload. Though one of the genius aspects of Vancian spellcasting was requiring players to keep only a small subset of their spellcasting options in working memory during actual play, but I digress. 5e's designers said clearly that they intended the first two levels of play to be totally skippable apprentice levels. That's why some classes receive their iconic defining features at second or third level to coincide with the graduation from the Academy of Paladins or with selecting their postgraduate specialty at Warthog School of Magecraft. So I can't fault anyone for skipping them. And really, 5e's overbloated character design means it doesn't matter whether you start at first or third or fifth level, it's still too damned much. That said, I want to turn the tables for a sec and ask why players object to starting at first level. Except I don't have to ask. I've heard all the arguments. I've heard first level characters are too limited and the game's too swingy and it doesn't feel like real D&D because sweet spot or some horse shit like that. And I don't buy any of them. After running various flavors of D&D and many other RPGs for approaching 4 decades now, and as someone who insists to this, And as someone who insists on starting at first level, and who that has therefore run more first level games than most GMs out there, I can tell you I see no evidence for any of that shit. Do you know what I think? I think it's about feelings. Not game feel, but actional, emotional fifis. Why should I, an experienced gamer who knows what I'm doing, have to start at first level every time? I think there's this weird-ass idea that starting at first level is akin to replaying a video game's tutorial slowly, methodically, and religiously, even though you've 100%ed the game 10 times already. Which, by the way, I also do, but I won't claim that sane or well-reasoned behavior. Well, I reject the idea that first level is baby's first level. I don't see it as a tutorial. Honestly, to me, it's a proving ground. If you can't play the game at first level, you don't deserve it at 10th level. And this ain't about gatekeeping, it ain't about earning your fun, and it sure as hell ain't about if you can't survive first level, you don't deserve to keep playing, because these days a lobotomized hamster could survive what passes for a first level challenge in modern D&D. This is about mentality and expectations. My role-playing games are about defining your character through play, about building a character organically, and about earning your victories. I don't give a crap what's on your character sheet. I care what you do when the dice hit the table. People who make a big thing about not starting at first level are generally people who won't like what I'm running. They're not usually interested in earning every line on the character sheet and building a character by playing it. I ain't saying it's a test of metal. It's just a thematic message about the games I run. When I force people to start at first level, I'm saying, in this world and in my game, you are no one until you make yourself someone. That's how it be. But that ain't all. But the next thing's kind of a finer point. As a game master, you can't ever forget that neither the game mechanics on the character sheet nor the mechanical game elements you include are what make your game interesting. If you can't build an engaging, interesting, and fun game at first level, when you're basically stuck with jumped-up peasants dealing with cellars full of dire rats, you're relying too much on the mechanics and spectacle. You need to focus on the world and its inhabitants. Skipping the low levels is kind of like skipping the first act of the story, not just narratively, but in mindset. A good story, one that lasts 6 months or a year or longer, needs to pace itself. Religiously forcing yourself and your players to start at first level makes you do that. and it reminds you that it's you, and not the mechanics, that make the game interesting. So there are narrative and thematic benefits to starting at first level. Starting there provides clear but nonverbal communication about campaign expectations, and starting at first level constrains you in ways that keep your skills and creativity sharp. If you don't care about that shit, skip first level, but I don't ever skip it lightly. That said, if 5e's designers had included a clearly marked and labeled apprentice level that really was designed as a pre-first level tutorial, and they'd executed it properly, I'd feel fine skipping that with non-newbies. I'll let you noodle how and why that's different, and what executed properly actually means. Steven asks, I have a player who is conducting research to discover information about a disease/cure. I don't know why Steven used disease/cure. About a cure for a disease, whatever. Anyway, I have a player who is conducting research to discover information about a disease/cure. They have the tools, the starting point, and the knowledge to ultimately come up with a solution, but it will take time. I don't want it to be just arbitrary dice rolls. That's boring. I also don't want this player being stuck in a research lab for months while the world burns around them. That takes them out of the action. I may be too late in fixing this issue now, but I'm curious how you might have handled this yourself, / would have avoided this altogether. Do you know what's boring, Steven? Unnecessary paragraphs. Even little ones. Why the hell would you bother describing your proposed solution anyway? Are you asking me how I would have handled this shit? You know what? I need to add a note here. Okay, so. So I just added a note at the end of the email that says, the email continues, but my reading of it did not. Do you know what's boring, Steven? Unnecessary paragraphs, even little ones. Why the hell would you bother describing your proposed solution anyway? Are you asking me how I would have handled this shit, or do you want my opinion on how you're handling it? At least you flagged the point in your email where the extraneous bullshit started, so I knew when to stop reading. But did you know there's a way in most email clients to flag paragraphs as unnecessary extraneous bullshit? On a Windows PC, just highlight the crap and then press the delete key. So, you have a character who has all the tools, resources, and knowledge they need to solve a problem, and now they've just got to put in the hours in the lab. Well, you're right that resolving it with a multitude of arbitrary die rolls would be boring. Do you know why? Because you designed a boring problem. The situation's boring because the player's got no choices to make and nothing to figure out. There's no game to play, and no game mechanics can fix that. People keep asking me to define push-button play, which I slag on a lot. Well, this right here is push-button play. The character has the skills and tools they need, and success is down to a die roll. The player has no choice and no say. All they can do is declare the action and wait to see the result. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, Steven. I assume there was some interesting gameplay that got the characters to this point, that they ended up with all the resources and knowledge after extensive amounts of gameplay adventuring and acquiring samples and all that crap. And now they're at the final stage of seeing how well the characters put all that shit together. But without really knowing how you structured all the resource acquisition crap, it's hard for me to say whether there's a value in rolling even one die roll. Did you build your campaign so the players had to gather the resources and information through their adventures? Did the amount and quality of the resources they gathered depend on their actions? Does the quality of the resources affect in any way the odds of their successfully crafting the cure? What are the possible outcomes? If the cure takes too long to develop, will there be a gradually growing body count? Will the players be forced to confront that information? Okay, the corpse pile is this big now. Roll for today's progress. Still not done. Well, I'll update you on the corpse count tomorrow. In short, is there anything about the die roll to make the cure that could have been different if the players had handled things differently? Could they have taken different actions that would have made it more likely now to formulate a better or faster cure? Can the players say, if only we'd just done this differently, we'd have saved more lives? If you can't honestly say yes, and not hypothetically yes, because if they'd had a really clever idea, I'd have pulled something out of my ass. If all the players did was check off boxes on a checklist and now it's down to rolling a check, don't waste time on dice. Just say, you go into the lab for 3 days. Behold, you have crafted the cure. Good job, you saved the lives. If the players, not the characters, the players with their skills and their brains, have no power to affect the outcome, and they never did, any game mechanic's just an arbitrary crapshoot. Skip it. Skip the in-world time, hand them the cure, and move on. Otherwise, if this really is the culmination of a complex series of the players' choices and interactions, and if they can pinpoint the things they could have done better, then rolling dice isn't arbitrary, it's the outcome they earned. And rolling a die for progress every day until it's done while delivering awful updates about how bad shit's going is the way to do it. And if the druid's out of the action for a few days and the other players are doing minor things to help keep things under control in the interim, things that can affect the outcome, that's fine too. That said, don't ever design any challenge that requires one single player to win by not playing the game for weeks or months of game time. Why would you ever do that? A few days of a split party while one character completes an ongoing and desperately needed task is fine, provided nothing too interesting happens to the rest of the party. But not weeks or months. Come on, Steven. Someone who can't follow simple instructions asks, you make a point of allowing yourself to be bored and to daydream in Better Narration Through Visualization, a lifestyle guide. That should be, it's a link, it doesn't have to be italicized. I'm curious about whether you've seen any research about how focused your boredom slash daydreaming need, what is it with the slashes? Everybody's doing slashes. Is it just covering up for the fact that you don't want to type the word or? Like, type the word or. I'm curious about whether you've seen any research about how focused, and I'm doing the air quotes because focused is in quotes, about, like, are we speaking sarcastically and not typing out our words? Anyway, I'm curious. You shouldn't send me emails because I'm then going to nitpick them. Which is hilarious because when people nitpick my grammar because out of 5,000 words, two errors slip through, you know, every 4 weeks or whatever, you know, I get pissed off. But nonetheless, you emailed me and you knew what you were getting into, person who can't follow simple instructions, so I make no apologies. Anyway, back to the email. You make a point of allowing yourself to be bored and to daydream in Better Narration Through Visualization, a lifestyle guide. And yes, I did just mispronounce it as daydream. But again, you're not allowed to correct me, but I can correct you. You make a point of allowing yourself to be bored and to daydream in Better Narration Through Visualization, a lifestyle guide. I'm curious about whether you've seen any research about how focused your boredom or daydreaming needs to be to work as an imagination or visualization aid. While dedicated time is good, is being bored at work worth it from the research you've seen? I have aspects of my job where it's automatic enough that I listen to podcasts and can function perfectly well. But is the focus even that work requires enough to spoil the benefits of daydreaming? And I did it again, and you're still not allowed to correct me. Lacking explicit permission, this is where I'm now answering. This is not me commenting or reading the email. We finally got through that. So, Lacking explicit permission to... Whoa, shit. What just happened? Okay. Did I lose the article or did I lose my changes? Okay. I don't know. Well, whatever. If I did, this is going to be a disaster. Okay. Now I have to go back and find my place. Lacking explicit permission to use your name or handle, I'm forced to make up a suitable appellation, and so I dub thee Dingleberry. That's far more polite than what I called you in my first draft. That said, don't look up the word Dingleberry because it's also not that polite. As I noted in the sidebar of the article that preceded Better Narration Through Visualization, a Lifestyle Guide, Game Mastering Makes No Sense, I ain't a research monkey and this ain't an academic paper. So I strongly recommend that any of you who want to know what the research says, do the legwork and check it out. That's the best way to get a good, convincing answer. Otherwise, you're at the mercy of some internet asshole's unsighted hearsay. That ain't me saying don't ask or leave me alone, by the way. I get that you're just curious about what I might have gleaned in my delving into the subject. I'm just saying that I ain't going to give you more than a surface-level answer, as it mostly pertains to Pretend Elf Games, and I ain't going to try to convince you what I know what I'm talking about. Feel free to dive into the topic yourself. It's interesting. First, the research on multitasking, dividing your attention between two tasks like podcast and work, is clear, categorical, and firm. Multitasking sucks. It's the worst way to do anything. No one's good at it. It's something you either suck at or you suck at slightly less. So if a thing's worth doing, it's worth your full attention and focus. And focus takes effort when you're doing something very familiar. The problem is that autopilot thing makes you slower, more error-prone, and more prone to inattentional blindness. That's one of several reasons why car accidents are more common when people drive on familiar roads, even after balancing for hours driven in unfamiliar and familiar places. In my opinion, therefore, the work time you spend being bored or daydreaming doesn't count. And I'm only giving you my opinion of how it pertains to your visualizing and game mastering skills here. I ain't judging how you handle your job. That's between you and your employer. Hell, I'm even going to let you have the I can divide my attention and function perfectly well lie. That's just my little gift to you, Dingleberry. And hopefully it'll soften the blow of my next paragraph. By asking the question, you're missing the point of Visualization, a Lifestyle Guide so damned hard, I'm pretty sure you deliberately turned around and ran away from the point as fast as your little legs would carry you. The point is we, all of us modern humans, have trained ourselves to be unable to handle boredom and crave stimulation, and we've ruined our ability to focus on just one thing. And that's really hurt our creative imagination. Look at what you're asking. Is it okay, angry, to not focus on just one task, work, because it's boring, and use that time to do my assigned daydreaming homework so I don't have to set aside exclusive time later? I want you to break your addiction to stimulation, to force yourself first to focus on the task before you, even if it's boring. And you have to force yourself because boredom hurts while you're detoxing. Then, when you can handle both focus and boredom, give yourself 15 dedicated minutes of non-stimulation to let your atrophied brain remember what imagination feels like. I can't tell you that your job's worth your full attention and focus. That one's on you. But I can tell you that if your game mastering skills are worth building, you'll give them 15 wholly quiet and unstimulated minutes a day. At the very least, you'll decree that it's worth focusing wholly on being totally unfocused for that. But wait, there's more, because Dingleberry also asks, also, you show some disdain for social combat as a concept in The Tao of Dice. Why is that, and what would you do instead? First, let me be absolutely clear. First, let me be absolutely and definitively clear about what I mean by social combat system. It's an abstraction, a way of modeling a conversation with game mechanics. And that may sound good until you really dig into what it means. Role-playing games' combat engines are abstract ways of modeling battles with game mechanics, and they're nothing like actual combat at all. That's fine because most role-playing gamers aren't trained combatants and they're not playing role-playing games to hone their combat arts. So it's okay that role-playing games boil combat down to abstract actions and simple choices anyone can make without actual knowledge of combat situations. Social combat systems, seen represented in games like Legend of the Five Rings, A Song of Ice and Fire, and Burning Wheel, and creeping bit by bit into the mechanics of modern and mainstream role-playing games, social combat systems do the same thing for social interactions. In such games, players don't decide what their characters say and then use the game's mechanics to determine how effectively the characters say it and how well it's received. Instead, without any reference to the actual words coming out of the character's mouth, even, say, a simple narrative description like, "My character tries to play on the merchant's sympathy with a lie about his sick mother." Instead, players choose abstract actions like small talk or debate or convince, and play dice games to deal damage to social hit points or reputation. The outcomes are determined in abstract ways. Did you ever play Pipe Dream? It was an arcade game wherein you had to arrange random pipe segments to connect spouts and drains before the viscous goo called flues, I shit you not, sprayed out the end. And in 2007, BioShock decided to use it as a way to represent the character's hacking skill. When you wanted to sabotage a vending machine or take control of a drone or gun turret, you had to play a little Pipe Dream minigame. Social combat systems are like that. Instead of trying to play an actual conversation, you've got to play a minigame with game mechanics to win. Metaphorically, not literally. And I bumped a key and lost my place again. Okay. Metaphorically, not literally. The consequence is those systems don't model the full length, breadth, and depth of human social communication, but rather focus on easy-to-make mechanical choices and simulated outcomes in broad strokes. The alternative is a system wherein players play out, or narratively describe, the conversation, which the game master then translates into game mechanics weighted by the character's social skills. Thus, you get a much richer, deeper experience. Obviously, I hope it's friggin' obvious anyway, I prefer the latter, for what I hope are obvious reasons. Now, some have argued that such a system requires players to be at least decent social communicators. And that's true. Players at my table do need to bring their own social skills to the table, though they need not be any level of interaction expert to win my social challenges. There's a difference between a challenge and difficulty, after all. People have asked me, quite fairly, I might add, what the difference is between requiring the players to bring their social skills and expecting the players to play out combat using their actual real-world swordsmanship skills. The difference is that tabletop role-playing games are social games. They're played through social interaction. They're played by talking. And thus, the one thing tabletop role-playing games can absolutely and effectively handle is social interaction. By the nature of the game itself, it isn't just possible to include social interaction, it's expected. Imagine you joined a martial arts or medieval sword fighting club. Imagine how you'd react if, at the first meeting, they showed you a giant chessboard on which you were expected to move. Imagine they presented you with a bunch of abstract combat simulation rules about where and when you could move. Imagine if they said you had to stay on the grid and you were only able to make one of 8 different attacks or defensive actions. And imagine if the outcomes were determined by a game of rock, paper, scissors. That'd be weird as hell, right? Social combat systems do the same for tabletop games. They turn the one thing you know the game is about, the one thing you know the game's going to test by its very nature, and turn that into a pile of abstract and restrictive game mechanical nonsense. Tabletop role-playing games are so good for social interaction and development that therapists and social workers have started using them to help people who have trouble socializing for various reasons improve their social skills. It's a cooperative, collaborative game. You can't play it without interacting socially, so you might as well train and reward that shit. Some still argue tabletop role-playing games have no business testing or requiring social skills. As someone who's tried to play games with players with no social skills, I call bullshit on that. Social skills are required. Some will argue that role-playing games should be inclusive and that they shouldn't exclude people who struggle with social interactions. But I can't think of anything more inclusive to people who struggle with social interactions than a game that aids in social skill development to such a degree it's used as a therapy tool. In the end, a game's gotta test something, or else it's not a game. Games must present challenges and obstacles. And while tabletop role-playing games are pretty good at testing critical thinking, resource management, and strategic thinking, they're uniquely suited to test and challenge social skills. Throwing that out's like throwing the punching out of boxing. That's why I think social combat systems aren't just crappy game systems, but also wrong-headed and misguided. I don't just dislike or disdain them. I think they actively make role-playing games and the people who play them worse games and worse people. How's that for a hot take? And that has been the Proofread Aloud, which is now done, and I will hopefully see you all next week. Back on schedule with a much more on-time Proofread Aloud.